10 years ago, something entirely new hit the airwaves.
You're listening to Radio Lab.
Radio Lab.
From
WNYC.
And NPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Jad Abumrad will be here. He is the host and creator of Radio Lab. He's a musician, a MacArthur genius, and he's bringing his unique brand of storytelling to the Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City on Saturday with a performance called Gut Churn. It illuminates the dark side of the creative process. This hour, we'll talk about his work, music, sound, and creativity. Join the conversation after the news. Okay, so about 10 years ago, a new show debuted on public radio that totally turned the public radio formula upside down. And this is a formula that we happily follow every day here on Talk of Iowa. Of course, we have a nice, smooth introduction. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. That is followed by some information about my plan for the hour and then a cohesive conversation or two or three, sometimes some calls. With me today is the man who threw the public radio playbook out the window and created Radiolab, Jad Abumrad. Hello, Jad.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's great to be here.
And now you're going to be performing at the Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City on Saturday at the Englert Theater at 8 p.m., a program called Gut Churn. And you have said that part of your creating this program, this live performance, was because you never felt like you had a good answer when people said, so how did you come up with the idea for Radiolab? So this is that answer?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting to hear your introduction about throwing out the playbook. I mean, I was asked at a certain point to talk about how did Radiolab happen and arrive at the strange, whatever it is, whatever sound it is that we are. I still have trouble describing it. Like, how did it get here? And so partially what this talk will be is that story of with behind-the-scenes clips and animations and videos and lots of sort of, you know, along the way mishaps to Radiolab becoming what it is. But as I was telling that story and thinking about it, really what I began to sort of dwell on were just how hard it was, all these moments of doubt and uncertainty along the way. And that actually became a topic in and of itself. And so I began to think, okay, like, what I know how I think about it, but like what could a poker player teach me about how to navigate moments of uncertainty? Because that's a game that's all about uncertainty. Or like how do theoretical biologists think about it? Because when a system is evolving, that system has no concept of where it's going. So like how do you think about uncertainty in biological systems? Or how do Cherokee shamans think about it? And so I just began to sort of do a whirlwind, almost Radiolab-y investigation of this feeling that was very much at the core of making Radiolab. And that's kind of the essence of the talk. It's the story of how it came to be, but it's also the story of how it felt.
That gut churn.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk more about your creative process as the hour goes on. But, you know, a lot of people who are listening to the show do listen to Radiolab. There are people who listen to the show who don't listen to Radiolab. And it's such an unusual program. I feel like we should talk about it a little bit for people who don't listen, and it's become a very big program for public radio. It's a hugely successful podcast. It's heard on more than 435 stations around the country. And when you try to describe it to people, how do you try to describe it?
Oh my God. It's like, I'm going to start talking and I'll just land into a fugue state. It's funny. It's like we used to have these public radio conferences way at the beginning, and it would be filled with program directors, and they are the people who you and I try and sell our shows to, right? And so I remember, you know, they would say, so what is Radiolab? And I'd say, well, it's like it's like two guys are at a diner, and we're just talking, right? But then one guy has like a little thought bubble, it goes, boop, and suddenly we go into the world of the thought bubble, and we're in this new universe, and we're exploring, and then we come back out, and we're in the diner again, and we're squabbling about what we just experienced. And then suddenly we turn to the left, and there's a scientist on the other table, and we talk to them. We're like, hey, cool. What do you have to say? And then we go back, and we're arguing. And I remember every time I would get into these moments, like they would just look at me like, really? Like, how did you get here? Who let you in? I don't really know how to describe it still. I mean, it is essentially a show about curiosity. It's a show about wandering headfirst into some thorny complexity and trying to experience that in as many ways as you can through interviews with scientists and philosophers, but also listening to stories where you hear people encountering that same idea, but in a completely different way. Sometimes we do radio drama. We've recently been doing a ton of very, very in-depth journalistic investigations into international politics. It's really a show that's very difficult to pin down, but if I had to summarize it in a sentence, it's about leading people to moments of wonder. You know, telling a story that leads a person to just stop and stand in awe of the universe.
My favorite thing about the show is when it sort of recreates the feeling that I have. If there's a subject that I've been interested in over my lifetime, you know, and I pick up a new book about it and I read something and that connects the dots with three other things. It's that moment of connection is
totally
what you create almost every episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think of it as, that's a really nice way of putting it. I think of it as that, like, that feeling you get when you read something or when a person tells you a story and you're like, no way, oh my God. Like, you get
right.
This brain fever, right? It just takes you over, and then it's gone, like, in 30 seconds, right? But for 30 seconds, you're on fire. And I feel like the goal of every story, and it sometimes they take 6 months to make, a year to make, but you're trying step by step to lead people back to that 30 seconds you had at the beginning. And so you can give them that little brain fever. So, yeah, I think it's exactly that.
And, of course, the two guys sitting in the cafe, that's you and Robert Krulwich.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that when people hear Radiolab on the radio or listen to the podcast, you know, it sounds like something different than anything that they've heard before. Although after 10 years, I guess it sounds like Radiolab. That is a sound in and of itself now. But I think that for those of us inside the public radio bubble, the show looks even riskier and even more out there. I mean, I remember the first time I heard the show, and it was the program director at the station I was working at then played it for me, and I was blown away. And she said, yeah, it's really amazing, but there are only 6 episodes. And we thought,
yeah, that's kind of the problem.
What do we do with that? Where do we play that? How do we make that into something? I mean, you really, when you came up with this concept, did you even think, how do I sell this thing?
Well, it's funny. I mean, we had to sort of invent a business model to wrap around it. I mean, because you're right. It's like we were toiling away in obscurity and making only a few of them. And public radio culture is all about sort of like, here's your slot, 1 hour every week, go. Or 1 hour every day, go. And just kind of keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. And even shows that, like, where the hosts are no longer doing the show, they still just kind of go. They just go into orbit in perpetuity. And, like, that's the public radio model, in a way. So here we were, these idiots with, like, 5 shows. And people just didn't know what to do with it. And actually, Ellen Horn, who has been sort of my partner from the beginning, came up with the crazy idea of marketing it as Shark Week. I don't know if you know, like, Discovery Channel Shark Week.
Uh-huh.
Apparently in, like, marine conservation worlds, like, you take a vacation on Shark Week and you cancel your plans and you just park yourself in front of the TV and just watch Shark Week. So she was like, can we make it an event like Shark Week? And so we pitched that to the people who sort of pull the levers on public radio. We were like, okay, here's the pitch. Terry Gross is on vacation. What do you do usually? Well, you usually air repeats of Terry Gross. Here's an idea. Air some Radiolab so she can go on vacation. You can give your listeners something new. And they know she's coming back. And it's all good. And that's literally how we made it work for the first few years was just piggybacking on Terry's vacations.
That seems like a really risky model as far as making a living. Were you afraid of that? Job security?
Well, at the beginning, it was not even a job. I mean, I have to be honest. Like, there was so little that we could use to justify this thing that, you know, I was working and being paid every so often. You know, I mean, it was sort of a volunteer labor of love art project obsession that then gradually began to sound like a radio show that actually could be legitimately called a show. But it was never, actually, I never planned it to be that way. It was just like, wow, here's a really cool story. What can we put next to it? And then what can we put next to that? And suddenly we have 59 minutes. Okay, that's a show. Let's put that. Okay, now let's do another one. And, I mean, it was also short-sighted and short-term. And the idea that it could actually go on and have a logic to it, that only came along like maybe 4 or 5 years after the fact.
Really? So yeah. I'm sure that the shows are also different, that they have different episodes probably evolved in different ways. But do you have kind of a routine? Do you come up with the big picture first, or do you have a story and think, oh, what can we build around that?
It's interesting. I mean, the shows happen both ways. I tend to find a story that's got a spooky thought in it. And I think to myself, oh, that spooky thought, I bet it could have babies. It could have other stories that could go with it. So I tend to think about the story and work up. Robert often thinks about a concept and then works down, like a concept like blood or like, I don't know, what's another one that he's really into right now? Elements is another one. Like, so just thinking of these large umbrella terms and then filtering down to the ground to find individual stories that explore that idea. And I would say 50% of the time the top-down thing works, and 50% of the time the bottom-up thing works. It's just that, and you know, these days our routine is every Friday the whole team gets together. We throw a bunch of stories at each other and try and win each other over. And often it's 6 months or to a year later that show gets on the air. And by that time, it's a very different show. It's gone through 5 or 6 phase shifts. But yeah, I don't know.
So do different people on the staff take different shows and kind of nurse them along? Or is everybody contributing to all the different shows at different times?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, every different producer that we have is working on 3 stories at once, I would guess, 3 or 4. And we're all working on the big shows together and also the podcast together. It's a very sort of mix and match, you know?
It also sounds like a really hard environment to get things finished in.
Yeah, I often get I often see people say like, "Wow, Radiolab is my dream job," and I'm like, "No, it's not. If you're here, I could kill the mystique in about 10 minutes." It can be very difficult because we live in a the stories live in this maybe space, this uncertain space. Again, thinking about gut churn for a long, long time, you know, before they hit the air.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Jad Abumrad. He is going to be performing at the Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City Saturday at the Englert Theater at 8 p.m. His performance is entitled Gut Churn. He's also the creator and host of the show Radiolab, which you can hear on Iowa Public Radio Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Jad Abumrad. He will be performing at the Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City Saturday at the Englert Theater at 8 p.m. His performance is called Gut Churn. Of course, most public radio listeners know him as the host and creator of Radiolab, which you can hear on Iowa Public Radio at 3 p.m. on Sunday. And before the break, we were talking about how these shows come about, how you work on them. And I think we should listen to a clip from one of them. This is just a short clip from your space episode.
Every civilization has an arc. You can think of it in threes.
Step one. Step two.
Let's welcome Seth Jackson and his Chesterfield Band of Stars.
How do you do, everybody?
And step three.
What the hell was that?
Well, a million years ago, we were practically apes. We'd hardly begun to have conversation. Now we have technology. We have radio and TV, and the universe can hear us. But how long will it be, do you think, before either for global warming or for some kind of war, we're...
The way the news has been recently, days.
All right, so that's just a little bit of discussion between you and Robert Krulwich talking about our time on Earth as humans. And that hour, I mean, you talk about space, but you're all over the place. You find out how it was that we figured out that we were not the center of the universe. My favorite part of the episode is when you are talking to Carl Sagan's widow and discover how he proposed to her. That was just a wonderful story. And you, before the break, you were talking about how Robert kind of comes up with these top-down ideas. Was that one of his?
No, that was a bottom up. I mean, okay. that was a situation where I went to visit Annie Druyan, Carl Sagan's widow, and I was interested in the Golden Record, which they'd put on the Voyager space capsules, which incidentally just left our solar system, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think it was a few months ago that was announced. So they sent it out, and the idea was some alien civilization a billion years from now would find these little capsule, open it up, somehow play this record, and then they would know about us. That would be so. On this record were sounds of humanity from different musicians, different greetings in all the different languages, sounds of the human brain neurons firing. So I went out there to ask her just sort of like, how did you decide what to put on the record? Because that's like a big job to figure out what should be on the mixtape of humanity. And she wove through that this love story of her and Carl Sagan were colleagues when they started that project. And right in the middle of the project, they fell in love in the most romantic way possible. And as she was literally in that moment of falling in love, they recorded the sound of her brain, sort of an EEG, the sound of her neurons firing, and that went onto the record. So literally is the sort of encoded neural firing of romance and falling in love. It goes onto that record. So it's just like a remarkable and lovely story, and we were sitting in her backyard, and there was a waterfall just behind her, and it was just one of these, like, I was just a baby reporter at that point. And so I had this great, lovely little tale from her. And then Robert sort of decided to be the skeptic, and he was like, well, let's talk about the prospects of an alien ever finding that thing. And that's the beginning of which you just heard that clip. And so it became a kind of dialogue. I had a story. He created a response story, and then we created a response story to that. And ultimately, the only word that we could use to sum it all up was space. And so it was just a word that was a quasi-theme to a collection of point-counterpoint stories, really.
The title of the show actually made me wonder if you ever regret using such a big title, because I can think of, 25 different radio labs that could be titled space, possibly,
totally,
in the future.
Totally.
So do you have some regrets?
Oh, totally. Like, especially these days, I find the idea of an episode with a title sort of frustrating because, we've gotten really into legal reporting recently. And what you see when you start to sort of sift through the Supreme Court docket and just look at the different ideas that are at play is that the same idea comes up again and again. Like, there are these tectonic plates that are just sort of moving beneath culture that are the same things, I mean, throughout not just our lives, but generations and generations. I mean, ideas about privacy versus security, the rights of the individual versus the rights of the collective. All of these ideas are underpinning everything. And the fact that we would then make an episode where we label it with one idea sort of undermines the fact that these ideas don't ever go away. And the fact that you call it an episode seems to indicate that it's done for you. So I've actually been thinking a lot about recently, like, how do you make, in the serial approach of episodes that just keep going and going and iteratively sort of, change and slowly over time, how do you articulate that to the listener? I don't know. I feel like that's a really interesting question for us right now.
At the same time, your listeners get really attached to certain episodes. I was doing a search yesterday just to see what people's favorite episodes of Radiolab are, and there are a lot of people talking about that online in different ways. And so they seem to latch on to these titles, too.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but I prefer to see it as, like, what's your favorite album? It's like, let's see, what would be, like, I don't know. Embarrassingly, I was just listening to Def Leppard, Pyromanian. I was like, I think that's my favorite Def Leppard album. I'm just going to out myself right now. And it's like, that's not like, that's just a moment in time for them. It's a musical moment in time. And then they make another album, which unfortunately was the next one, which is terrible. But that's, you know, I prefer to think the episodes that way. It's not constraining an idea, but constraining a moment in time.
Now, since you brought up music, you actually score a lot of the episodes as well, right?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I got into this whole business sort of ass backward. I was a composer and a musician, and I liked the idea of working in a place where you could play with noises and sounds and push them around and manipulate them. And I only learned the journalism after the fact, which I've come to really love and embrace, but I think at my base, I'm a music guy. And so when we're doing the stories, there's a portion of the process where I'll close the door and I'll just start making music that goes with these stories. And now I share that with another guy, Dylan Keefe, and we do it together. But and it's also just because now we're a very big podcast, and on the podcast, the music rights are different than on the air. And so it's much harder to use other people's music. So it, in a way, forces us to have to write a lot of the music. But I love that part. For me, the stories and the music are somehow the same thing. They grow from the same germ. And any great story is weirdly a musical act. And I love that process of trying to tease the music out of a story or trying to tease the story out of a music.
The process of putting together Radiolab, and this is a little too inside baseball, but still, when I hear the show, I can hear the work that's gone into it because I'm a radio person. I can hear the edits. I can hear how many different interviews you've had to do to put together one story. And then I think about the fact that you also want to score that, and I think, are you crazy?
Yeah, it can be a little bit daunting. I don't know. The music part of it is what just gets me up in the morning. I don't know, like for me, when you're doing, let me think about this, epigenetics, okay? We did a big thing about epigenetics, which is basically that phenomenon that was recently discovered that if your grandfather starved, like went through the potato famine, that confers upon you a weird kind of protection against certain diseases. Right, so that there's a marker that is placed in your gene from your grandfather that filters through time and gives you a certain armor against certain things. And I was like, wow, what a cool idea. Well, in order to understand how it works, it's incredibly wonky in science, and you have to talk about cascades of chemical responses. Like the classic epigenetics thing is like a rat mother licks her baby, and it turns out that when the tongue brushes the fur of the baby, all of these chemical changes happen that filter all the way down to the DNA. Well, we wanted to tell that story, but you end up using all these crazy nouns about, you know, poly something proteins and blah, blah, blah. And it gets so abstract so quickly. But I love the challenge of taking that heavy abstraction and making it dance. Like, can I make it? It's sort of like taking a giant elephant and strapping on ballerina shoes. And like, can I make the elephant dance? That's actually the funnest part of the job. It's the hardest part, but that's where the music and the sound and the composition kind of come into, can I make it move so it never feels like a leaden bit of homework?
Do you, when you score the show, I mean, do you compose because of what is on the show, or do you use compositions that you have already come up with?
Mostly the first, you know, usually what we do is, and I apologize in advance if this is too inside baseball, but usually what it is, it's like you tell a story and there are these natural rhythms and cadences in the story, and you want to accentuate that. And so the music initially becomes a kind of punctuation. It's as opposed to like having, like imagine having a one run-on sentence and then suddenly introducing a period or a comma. The period gives the opportunity to separate thoughts, you know, and so you use the music in the same way. So it's like da 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 la 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 da 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 la la la, and so the music becomes just a gap, a way to string disparate thoughts together, and so that your brain can separate those thoughts. But then it becomes a bit of a, then there's the sort of other thing that music does, which is to sort of take the emotional content that's in a story and amplify that. And so usually what we do is we listen to the stories and we look for where does it need to be punctuated and where do you want your heart to sing, you know? And you just try and tease from the story those musical moments that accomplish those things.
We have a great example of this that we can play. This is from your episode, Animal Minds. And in the episode, toward the beginning, we hear from a group of divers who rescued a humpback whale. And then they shared this really incredible moment with the whale. And the divers are convinced that the whale found a way to say thank you to them.
So Tim and James and the other divers are in the water. They're celebrating, high-fiving. And then all of a sudden, James looks down.
Next thing I know, I have this 50-ton whale coming right at me. I'm thinking, oh my God, stop, I just saved you.
Wait, so this whale is coming at you from below, like Jaws?
Yeah, she's rising up towards me.
Oh God.
And I'm just thinking, this is going to hurt.
And
when she was only inches away from my chest, she stopped. And pushed me on the chest backwards and then released me and then kind of pushed again and then released and pushed again and again.
Wow.
And then she swam up right next to me, picks her head up above the water so that her eye was above the water, and then came up and looked directly at me.
That's from the episode Animal Minds, and I think that really illustrates the use of music to punctuate the story beautifully. That particular episode, yesterday I was driving a carpool to dance class, and I had a 10-year-old, 2 9-year-olds, and a 5-year-old in the car with me, and I said, okay, guys, I need to do some work, so we're going to listen to this show. They were completely transfixed. And,
oh, wow.
And the 5-year-old kept giggling all the way through it, because I don't know if she thought it was going to be funny or not, but it was almost like she was uncomfortable by the moments of silence and the cadence, and it kept making her laugh. But I was really amazed by how transfixed all of them were, and they all said that they really liked the show, and now they'll listen. So you have a bunch of new listeners in elementary school. Have you heard that from other parents, that this is a show that really crosses generations?
Well, we hear it every time we do a story about rape and murder and that kind of thing.
I listen to the show with my kids and you just betrayed me.
I know. We do a lot of dark stories. And then we do a lot of stories like the one you just heard. And every time we do a dark story, we get a lot of people saying, I'm listening to it with my 8-year-old and then this thing comes on. And, you know, we put warnings and we're trying to be very responsible about that stuff. But and when we do live shows, I'm amazed by the number of 11-year-olds in the audience. That's kind of amazing to me. That's sort of the greatest compliment I can imagine, that two people, like two generations, could come together. In a way, that's weirdly the DNA of the relationship with Robert and I. You know, we're like completely like-minded, but 25 years apart. And so when you see that mirrored in the audience in other generational divides, I feel like that's just kind of amazing. I'm very thankful for that.
That episode that we were just listening to a little bit of, the big question is, how well can we really know the minds of animals? It is not a question that you answer in that episode. There are a lot of unanswered questions on Radiolab. Do you have favorites? Favorite unanswered questions that you just feel like no one can ever settle?
I mean, my favorite of the moment, and it's only because it's the very last thing we did, we just aired a story about a group of punk rock musicians in Cuba who during the 80s and 90s, this was at a time when Fidel Castro's government was sort of retaliating against what it deemed antisocial behavior, which included everyone from, you know, priests, homosexuals, to kids with long hair who listened to rock music. So these kids, these rockers, basically found a way to protest the government by, to make a long story short, injecting themselves with HIV because at the time there were all these ads around that said, you know, socialismo or muerte, which is socialism or death. And they were basically like saying to the government, oh, yeah, well, we choose death. And it was this incredibly fierce and sad and tragic protest. And one of the questions that came out of it for me, which I just can't stop thinking about the last few days, is like, what happens if the protest does more damage to you than the system? Which seems to be a question which resonates through so many aspects of political life these days. Like, what happens when it hurts you more than it hurts the quote man? Does it matter less? Is it still worth doing? I don't know. So I've been thinking about that question, and I'm not sure that's a question that has an answer.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Jad Amunrad. He is the host and creator of Radio Lab. He's also a MacArthur genius. He's going to be performing in Iowa City Saturday night at the Englert Theater at 8 p.m. His performance is called Gut Churn. It's part of the Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City. We'll be back in a moment, and you're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Jad Amunrad. He is the creator and host of Radio Lab, which airs on more than 435 public radio stations around the country. It's also an incredibly popular podcast. You can hear it on Iowa Public Radio, 3 p.m. on Sundays. He'll be performing in Iowa City Saturday night as part of the Mission Creek Festival. He'll be at the Englert Theater at 8 p.m. with a performance called Gut Churn. And I'm curious, you've made several comments about it during the hour, talking about getting into public radio, into journalism in a backwards sense. What did you train to be? What was your career goal when you were in college?
My career goal was to write music generally, but more specifically for films. I went to the composition department at Oberlin College, and I also minored in creative writing, and I came out of there like basically pretty sure I was going to write music for the rest of my life, and then maybe in the next 3 years discovered that I was actually really bad at it. And so I had that sort of like 4 years out of college flailing moment where I realized the thing that I had, my dream, was not working. And consequently, I then wandered into radio because I thought, oh, well, it's kind of sort of music-y. It's got sound in it, and I also like to write, so maybe it's you know, it's that too. And weirdly, now 10 years later, I find that I'm like, the composer has snuck back in. It's like he's snuck in through the side door. So yeah, it was interesting that I thought I was going to be a musician, but here I am talking to you about this other thing that somehow happened weirdly.
Was there a moment when you realized you were in the right place? Was there sort of a feeling of homecoming at a point?
I don't know if there was a moment. I remember this is one of many moments. I remember back in the days when no one was listening, which was a long, vast Khyber Pass I had to wander through before we actually got onto radio stations. I remember having this like very simple problem, which is that how do I talk about the show at the top of the show? You actually mentioned it yourself at the beginning. It's like, how do you begin the show? It's this quintessential annoying problem we have to solve as when we go on the radio, which is like, how do you announce yourself? How do you tell people what's about to happen? And so I was sitting there thinking like, God, I need to do something so that people understand where they are when they land in Radio Lab. But I don't want to have a theme song. Theme songs. I hate theme songs. So I was like, okay, what do I do if I don't want to have a theme song? Okay, well, I'll make these little 20-second blurby little weird mashups, and that'll be like a theme song. I'll just play that at the beginning and then go on with the show. So I basically stayed up all night this one night taking the sounds of static, the sounds of weird, glitchy piano notes, recordings that I made with people that were in the building at that moment, saying you're listening to Radiolab, and I kind of cut it up into 1,000 pieces and reassembled it and made about 30 of these little 30-second sonic IDs or whatever you call them. And I remember listening to them and being like, that's weird. Like, there's no other thing to call that besides music. Like, it didn't seem to me at that moment that I had been making music. And then suddenly there I was, and I was like, oh my God, I'm making music again. I didn't think I was doing that anymore. So that was one of the moments where I realized that Radiolab actually was a kind of composition. You know, it was not just straight journalism. It was actually a musical version of journalism in a way.
The shows that you've put together, do you come up with a topic that you can't pursue, that you try and then have to throw out?
You know, I mean, we did a show on colors once, and that was a turning point for me, because at that I was vociferously taking the position that we cannot do a show on colors.
It is a brilliant show too, and the podcast is 70 minutes long, so it's you had so much good color stuff that you couldn't even fit it in an hour of radio.
I know, but I was like, I'm a huge TV junkie, and I was like, there's no, and I am a devotee of TV, and so I know what TV is good at, and I know what radio is good at, and radio we just can't do colors. Like, there's no way to talk about colors in a way that like conveys the brilliance and the vibrancy of certain colors. But then we went off, and I remember we were faced with a problem, and I talk about this in the talk that I'm doing on Saturday. We were faced with the problem of, like, how do you express what a mantis shrimp sees when it looks at the rainbow? I won't even tell you how we got to that ridiculous question, but it turns out the mantis shrimp has 16 rods and cones in its eyes, and we only have 3. So this shrimp, I mean, if you imagine it looking at a rainbow, it's seeing the craziest ultraviolets and infrareds. I mean, that's amazing. Can we render that for our audience? That was the question that was before us. And I was like, no. Like, not only can we not see those colors, but you're talking about a creature that is seeing beyond human perception. Like, it's quadruply impossible. But we ended up, somebody on the show had the idea, well, let's hire a choir and have them sing the different frequencies of the rainbow, and we could harmonize it so you could hear the harmonies grow, which seemed like a kind of an interesting idea, but like really had no business working. And like it just somehow, it turns out choir people are incredibly generous and amazing, and like you put out a thing on a listserv, suddenly within hours, 120 people are standing in this church and we're conducting this choir. And I remember doing that and being like, oh my God, if we can do this, I no longer believe in the limitations of this medium. Like, this is amazing. Like, we're singing the infrared color spectrum, and it actually feels infrared. I was like, okay, anything is possible now.
Well, and the amazing thing about that show is, I don't think you could have done it visually, because you can't.
Yeah, maybe.
You can't show people those colors. You just can't, because we can't see them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
What does the future look like for you? I mean, you received the MacArthur Genius Grant in 2011, which is a huge moment in life. I know that led to this program taking a gut churn on the road. But where do you go from here? What do you see?
I don't know. I mean, I think I see, I think on the most basic level, I just want to keep doing it. Even at the worst moments of Radiolab, when it's 4 a.m. and if we've blown a deadline, which unfortunately happens all too frequently, it's still a gift in those moments. It's still amazing that like we get to, you know, be interested in something and then just get to go run out into the world and pursue that interest. That to me actually feels like a real amazing thing. And I think what I hope for the show, what I hope for myself, is to get out there in the world more, you know, just to like get outside on every level, get outside our comfort zone, get outside the topics with which we're comfortable, get outside our usual forms, our usual sounds, our usual styles, but just to push farther. Because these shows work because very simply, we, the producers, are learning something. We're changing as people in the course of making a show or a story within that show. They only work when that's happening. And so I want to put myself, my producers, and my program in situations that are profoundly uncomfortable. And so, you know, what we've been doing in the last 6 months, in the last year, and I hope continue to do, is to explore stories and topics that are just traditionally not our thing, but that we're interested in and that we want to learn about and that we want to grow as people from within. And so really, that's it. I just want to keep going farther.
When I hear the phrase gut churn, I think about that mixture of nervousness, fear, and excitement all at the same time. Is that what you're trying to convey?
Yeah, I think it's about the putting yourself in the place where it doesn't feel right and learning to recognize when the bad feelings are useful, you know? I mean, that's been a conversation I've been having with myself from the beginning, which is, okay, wow, I don't really know what I'm doing right now, and I don't have a template, and I feel kind of crummy. I don't think I like this feeling. I want it to stop. But now I'm in a place now where I'm like, well, maybe I need a certain percentage of that feeling in my life. And like learning to use that feeling as almost like a poker player places bets, like learning to recognize that it's part of the hand that you're playing. You know, it's an ace in a set of five cards. And if you don't have that ace, it doesn't complete the hand. I think of it that way. I think of gut churn now as a tool, as an indication that you're doing something worth doing. Too much of it can be paralyzing. And so it's not to glorify it indiscriminately. I think there is such a thing as too much fear and too much stress. And there are people who get paralyzed by that. So for me, it's been a conversation about figuring out how much is just enough.
Let's go back to Def Leppard. When we think about some of our favorite artists, you know, there's usually a point in their careers where they stop creating new stuff that really excites us. And of course, you know, people describe that in a lot of different ways. But one of the ways that it gets described is as, you know, they're too complacent. Mm-hmm. So do you find yourself almost engineering that gut churn to make sure that you don't get too complacent?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think about one of the personal simple math equations that I hold for myself is that every third story or one out of every three stories has to hurt a little bit, not too much. And so it's a rhythm that I've sort of like internalized. So now it's like you do a couple stories and yeah, I give myself a couple hall passes, you know, because like you got these deadlines, you got to meet the deadlines. But if that happens like four or five times in a row, and I'm like, oh, you know, I begin to get really, really uncomfortable. Like, there's a way in which if it's painful, every so often, not too painful again, but just a little painful, where you're just things aren't going the way you thought. You're missing, you know, you say I've got to be out of here by 8 p.m. and suddenly it's 2 a.m. That has to happen one out of every three times for me to know in my gut that we're actually still going outside. I mean, it could just be because then I'm a dysfunctional, like, you know, non-adult. But I actually think that like the pain is actually there. Pain evolutionarily is a signal. That's all it is. It's a message to the body. And I feel like creatively, there has to be those pain messages in order for the creative act to be still not complacent, you know?
Speaking of not being an adult, there have been studies that have looked at the periods in people's lives when they are most creatively productive. And for a lot of people, that is in their 20s, before they get involved in all of the responsibilities of life. And you are an adult and you're a dad now. Do you find that there's a lot of push and pull there between the show that you have described as eating you alive and all of the other wonderful things about life that you want to be doing and need to be doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a push and pull. It's like there's just not enough time in the day now. And if I'm toiling away too late at night on a story, that's by definition now time I'm not spending with my kids. So, yeah, it's the calculation changes a lot. But, you know, in to the more general point, I mean, there's a lot of examples, too, of people who just don't stop being creative. I mean, we're putting together a live show which is going to present a kind of almost biopic of Oliver Sacks, who's been on our show a million times. And he and Robert have had this sort of ongoing conversation for almost 40 years. And that's a guy who has not stopped. I mean, he's continued to be incredibly adventurous and creative his entire life, writing almost a book a year, sometimes more. And every single one seems to explore a new facet of the human experience. So, you know, I look at those guys and I think, okay, I'll just try and do even a tenth of what that guy does, and hopefully it'll all turn out fine.
Do you think that the people who can keep that kind of creative process going, are they different kind of people, or have they just found a different way of working?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I think they might be different. I hate to say that, but there's an eternal... I mean, I see this in Robert, too. I mean, Robert is the craziest, smartest, most eternally buoyant individual I've ever met. And I often think to myself, how are you so excited all the time about learning something new? How does it never get old for you? And maybe that's a routine I should actually have this conversation with him. It's a routine he goes through, but maybe it's just disposition. Like, he just has a kind of childlike quality that propels him. And definitely Oliver has that. And maybe, I don't know, there's a sense of just like something, there's some kind of internal flame that never kind of gets diminished. So I don't know. That's a good question.
You have talked a lot about public radio. People ask you questions about public radio because you've done something so remarkable within this medium. And at the beginning of the hour, we were talking about the formula that you threw out when you created Radiolab. But some of the real, I guess, structure breaking or, you know, new things that we hear on public radio then spawn a lot of copycats. So, you know, This American Life, Radiolab, there's a cadence, there's a way of talking that then other people try to mimic, and you start hearing it all over the place, and you think that's not genuine, you know, that's not the same mm-hmm. kind of thing. So what does public radio need, in your opinion, to break out of our formulaic mold?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question.
And you've got 60 seconds to tell me, so plenty of time.
Maybe we just need more things coming through our pipeline a little faster. I don't know what the next sound will be. By definition, it'll be something that is unknown. But I think we should just have, like, I like the way in which TV has pilot seasons, and a vast majority of what gets on there doesn't stick and gets canceled. And I would hope for public radio that there'd be a little bit more of that in our system, that new voices are coming in, they're being given a shot. And then if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out, you know. And then the next cohort steps up. I want more faster. I guess that's what I want.
Jad, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh yeah, that was such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jad Abumrad is the host and creator of Radiolab. He'll be performing at the Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City Saturday night at the Englert Theater at 8 p.m. His performance is entitled Gut Churn. We're going out with one of his compositions today. This is called Counting in C, remixed. And also, Iowa Public Radio Studio 1 will be hosting a series of live broadcasts as part of the Mission Creek Festival. You can tune in at 7 o'clock tomorrow night for a set with Riley Walker and an interview with the band Real Estate, hosted by Ben Kiefer. On Friday, another live set, also starting at 7. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.